Well, today's topic was, as we said, labeled forbidden marriages. But I just want to get introduced to what we're talking about, just to give it a little broader perspective. This is actually a hard one to discuss, because a lot of these topics for us are difficult to understand in terms of why people are excluded from marrying into the typical Jew. And I want to kind of discuss exactly where this comes from, give it a framework. Now, in our society around us, now, based on the ideas of being politically correct, we don't like to take a group of people and say these people are not worthy of X or Y. Because everyone, really essentially everyone is created equal in many ways, and everyone does have merit, and everyone should get a chance. But halacha does exclude certain people from certain marriages. I want to get more involved into why that is. I'm not going to talk about marriages like incestual marriages, because that's more obvious to us. We understand incest, even in the modern world, we understand 100% there's issues with it, both in terms of genes, morality, etc. So I'm not getting involved in marrying a sister or a mother or a daughter, things like that. That's much more self-evident to us. The people I want to discuss, I'm going to discuss five different people who are forbidden to marry, at least marry into the typical natural-born Jewish line. And those five, I'll list them, and then we'll give a little more of an introduction to it. The five are a mamzer, a Ammoni. I mentioned these last week also, an Ammoni, so a convert from the nation of Ammon, a convert from Moab, a convert from Egypt to Mitzri, and a convert from Edom, an Edomi. So those are, you have four nations which even their converts can't marry into the Jewish people, and you have a mamzer. So I want to get more into those topics, understand a little more about why this is, what's wrong with these people that they can't marry into the Jewish people. When it concerning every single one of these people, the Torah uses the same exact language, which is the language is lo yavo b'kal Hashem. They can't enter into the congregation of Hashem. So it's not, we'll discuss more, it's not forbidding marriage totally across the board. Many marriages are okay for them to do, but they can't marry into what's called the Kahal Hashem, the congregation of God. What that means is that anybody who is of one of these classifications, they could marry each other. So a Ammoni convert can marry a Mitzri convert, a Mamzer can marry an Ammoni convert. You can mix and match these people. These people are called, they're not called Kal Hashem, they're outside the congregation of Hashem. They're Jews, 100% Jews. There's nothing wrong with them as Jews. They're totally part of the people. We have mitzvah to love them and care for them, and everything we do to a Jew, we do to them. But they have this limitation on marriage, but yet they can marry each other. And that's okay to do.
What do you mean each other? Like Ammoni and Ammonit?
Right, or Ammoni and Moavit, or Ammoni and Mitzrit. Yeah, right, that's okay to
even
do.
Even Mamzer.
Mamzer and Ammoni, yeah, correct, they're allowed to. The kids will still take on the stigma, which we'll talk about, but they're allowed to do it. No, that doesn't mean that they get rid of the stigma. The stigma remains for a Mamzer for sure. So I want to get to each one individually, but again, the broader picture here is that you're entering into the Jewish people. The Jewish people are a very, very pure, pristine line from the patriarchs and matriarchs, through the 12 Shvatim, the tribes, going through the Jews who stood there at Mount Sinai and got the Torah, and onwards. So there's a line of Jewish, of natural-born Jews, which is called Kal Hashem. This is the congregation of God. Entering into this congregation through marriage, with the family bond, to be totally included, we consider somewhat of a merit or a privilege, let's call it. So therefore, if you're entering into this line, you have to be someone who we feel is fit to enter into this line. The core of the Jewish people remains very, very pure and pristine. And somebody who Hashem, and only Hashem can decide this, who Hashem deems to be not worthy to marry in, only Hashem can make this decision. We can't determine this. That means that person's, there's something about them that might somewhat, let's say, taint the pure line of Jewish lineage. And again, I want to be clear, they convert, they're 100% Jewish, there's no question about the Jewish identity, no question about their obligations and mitzvahs, no question about our mitzvah to love them and care for them as Jews, but they're limited in their marriage. Somebody who is not in what we call the kahal cannot marry into the kahal. Somebody who is outside can marry each other, as we said, but they can't marry in. Additionally, when we say, let's take an example, an Egyptian convert cannot marry into the Jewish line, it's not that every single Egyptian is a bad person. But we have to look at it, only Hashem can deem that, can actually make this call. We can't make the call. We would never say that any person can't marry unless Hashem said so. And that person, we have to say that a majority of Egyptians may have such and such a trait, which we'll discuss, which is inborn. And even though they're wonderful people, there is an overwhelming majority of people of X nation, whatever nation we're talking about, that might have a certain trait which we don't want to enter into our line as Jews. Again, these things are hard for us to understand and to determine, and I'm not going to get more into it, but that's the perspective on it. And I just take a very rough analogy. Let's say you have a kid in school, and, yeah.
Rabbi, I apologize for coming in late, so I might have missed your point. But are you saying that people who have converted, and this is fully converted to Judaism, that they are somehow not permitted to marry?
No, I'm not saying that at all. It's only there's four exceptions.
Fine.
Most converts are totally fine, marry any Jew they want, 100%. We're going to discuss there's four nations that are exceptions. Actually, nowadays it's not relevant, we'll discuss as well. But these four nations were exceptions in the Torah, and they couldn't marry in. But we'll talk more about specifics. Yeah, but 99% of converts are totally accepted, marry in, no issues at all. I guess the rough analogy to give would be, let's say that you have kids in a classroom. So you have a very nice, quiet, you know, gentle kid. And all the other kids in the class are like these rowdy, rougher, you know, bully type kids. So it's not your place to judge the other kids, but you don't want your kid getting involved with those other kids. So you might want to say, I want to switch my kid's class because I'd rather him not be influenced by the ones around him. So we're not judging them. We're not judging, you know, they could be great people and they might, you know, mature and become wonderful citizens. But we have to understand that you want to be sure that you protect your own and therefore you don't want them to be influenced by those around. So it's something we understand. Let's say another instance. There's another example we'll talk more about. We know that nowadays we've discovered many, many genetic diseases, genetic disorders. So couples, before they get married, will get tested. You know, are they carriers of these different genetic disorders? And if they're told, oh, you're both carriers, often couples will decide not to get married because it's not worth the risk that maybe we'll have a child, God forbid, with a terrible disorder. So even though both parents are great, and they're great people, and the trait, and it's not for sure, I mean, you could both be carriers, but the kid still may not have the disorder. People play it safe and avoid that bond because they don't want to bring into the world that negative disorder. So if we were to say that a person from such and such nation has in him, he's a carrier of a very negative trait. And even though not every single person in the nation is going to have that trait, even though my kid might turn out totally fine, we don't want to take the risk of bringing that negative trait into the world. So these are all perspectives on the issue. Well, let's go through it piece by piece and understand the details. So the first one, which is possibly the most difficult one to discuss, is the concept of a mamzer. A mamzer is a very tragic topic, a very difficult topic. A mamzer, halachically, is a child born from a relationship which we would deem a rayus, which means that it's a relationship which would carry that relationship would carry with it the death penalty or the penalty of kares. Kares is another very severe punishment the Torah gives. So this excludes, you know, a child born between a Jew and non-Jew is not a mamzer. A child born out of wedlock is not a mamzer. A child born from a nida is not a mamzer, even though these relationships are forbidden. A mamzer is created by an incestual relationship or an adulterous relationship. Those would be the two types of relationships that create a mamzer. These are instances that create, those are both considered very severe sins, those relationships. And if a child comes from one of those relationships, that child is deemed a mamzer. What's so tragic about being a mamzer is that it's forever. You can't ever rid yourself of that stigma. The child, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, it goes on forever. It's a very, very serious and tragic stigma that a child could receive based on the parents' actions. It's hard for us to understand because the child did nothing wrong. I mean, the child is an innocent child born from parents who did something wrong. But what did the child do? There's a halachic imperative which you find in many, many sources that we do whatever we can to try to invalidate a mamzer, his status. Meaning that if a rabbi, we're talking about the greatest rabbis, and the regular everyday rabbis don't do this, but you know, you have people who are gedolei hador, you know, the generation looks towards these people to make very, very difficult decisions. And they will go at lengths and extremes halachically to find some basis to permit a mamzer, meaning to undo the status, which often might come out using a very big loophole or relying upon a very, very lenient opinion. But we understand how serious the status could be on a person. And whenever possible, again, only an Adam Gadol can do this. You have to have a very great person to make these decisions. But a person of that caliber, he will do his best to try to find some way to release him from that status. It's not always possible. But when it is, they try to find some way to do it.
Okay. Yeah. A little clarity on this.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I understand the adulterous part of it. But what if, in the state of Maryland, there's this, actually, it's not uncommon, but if there's a married couple and one of them, if the male impregnated another woman, the state of Maryland will allow an immediate divorce so that that child can, that the other woman's carrying, the parents will be married at the time of the birth.
Right.
So would that child be a mumser?
Yes, the conception is what matters,
it's the conception, not the birth.
Yes,
not if the other woman is not married.
If she's a married woman. Meaning, if the woman's a married woman at the time of conception, right?
So both parties have to be married at the time.
Well, halachically, a man can have more than one wife. So even though we don't do this anymore, but that's permitted according to the Torah. So that wouldn't create a mamzer. It's only if she's a married woman. Right.
Thank you for clarifying.
And someone other than her husband conceives with her. That's the problem, right? It's the conception. It's a good question. It's the conception, not the birth.
Rabbinically, it's still prohibited, but it doesn't produce, since it's not Torahically permitted.
Right.
It doesn't
produce a mamzer. Yes.
Who knows who is a mamzer, who is not. People don't publicize it.
I mean, people who unfortunately are, they know their status. I mean, it's they have to know their status, but it's not something you publicize. It's very embarrassing. It's a stigma. I mean, but people don't publicize it. So we have to understand a little bit, you know, why is the Torah so strict on this child? Again, we said the child didn't do anything wrong. It's on the parents, but yet the stigma remains on the child for eternity. It's a very difficult situation. So, I mean, one thing, like I said before, we have to understand that even in the world of spirituality, there's a reality which is there. I mean, we understand the concept of, you know, if a mother is pregnant, is an alcoholic, and she drinks and drinks and drinks, it will affect her child. That's scientifically proven. We understand the idea of a crack baby is the parents are on drugs, the mother's on drugs, and it affects the child. So the child did nothing wrong. That child is totally innocent, but because the mother did something wrong during pregnancy, that impacts the child. So spiritually we have that as well. There's a spiritual reality when a child is conceived. And the way the child is conceived impacts the nature of the child. And even though the child did nothing wrong, actions have consequences. We look at it as there's a reality involved, and that can produce a child that has this stigma. The Rambam tells us that one reason the Torah is so strict about a mamzer is because this serves as a major deterrent for people getting involved in illicit relationships. I mean, some might say, you know what, for myself, you know, I'm willing to do it. I don't care. You know, but for every reason, a person can say that I'm willing to get involved in this relationship. But you have over your head the reality of a child is going to live with this for his or her entire life, and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, all the way to the end of the days, that might stop a person, because that's a scary thought to have. You might say, for myself, I'll deal with it. That's a person's own imperative, but you don't want to impact children in that way. So the Rambam says this serves as a major deterrent to immoral relationships. That's the Rambam tells us. Another commentary, the Ralbag, he tells us that because the sin is considered such a terrible sin, it's never forgotten. I mean, it's the other side of the coin. What you're doing is so terrible that Hashem doesn't let that become forgotten. And then the Sefer Chinuch teaches us that, like we said before, the nature of the parents is in the children. And when a parent does such an act, the nature of these parents is passed on to the child. And that child's going to have something within which we view it as a difficult trait, difficult characteristic, which sticks with them for forever. So even though it's hard for us to understand how is it fair and understand the status, we have to understand it is a reality. We understand there is this thing as there's genes and there's spiritual genes. And things get passed on, which that person who does have the status of mamzer, is there something within, we can't always pinpoint it, but something within which is not suitable to marry into the rest of the Jewish people. Now a mamzer can marry another mamzer. A mamzer is allowed to marry a convert. That's okay, it's allowed. A mamzer is allowed to marry even one of the forbidden converts a mamzer can marry. But that won't change the status. I mean, even though they're allowed to be married, they're allowed to have children, their children still have the status of mamzerim. So that the stigma cannot be removed, but yet they're allowed. So the mamzer does have opportunity for marriage. Marriage is allowed with a very limited pool of people.
And the status goes from either the father or the mother?
Yes, either father or mother, correct. If any parents are moms, the status is passed on.
So moms can marry a moni, a monit.
Right, or even a regular ger. Moms can marry a regular ger as well. Just most gerim will not want to do that because their kids are going to have the status of mom. No, so the other party might want to be involved in that, but they're allowed to. It's allowed. It's permitted.
He said either parent, but so the adulteress is the woman, a married woman. So what were you saying that if it's either parent? When would it be a male?
Her son.
Then once the child's born, the child's a mamzer or a mamzeress, a female mamzer. And then, now they can marry, if either one has a child now, even through a person who's not a mamzer, the child still is a mamzer. That's mamzeris. It's very difficult, but it teaches us how serious we look at illicit relationships and how we have to be so careful of these types of things. It also shows us the reality of spiritual genes, like I like to call it. There is a reality of spiritual genes that gets passed down parent to child, and that's a reality in a person. We see it in life. We understand that children have traits of parents. We all see that very commonly. And you know, we meet someone and say, you're just like your mother, you're just like your father. Not just in looks, but even in personality, even in gestures, even in the tone of their voice sometimes. We see this. So spiritually, it's the same reality. And that spiritual reality does connect to the child. So I'll move on to the next group of people we discussed. So if a person converts from Ammon or Moav, one of those two nations, that person is not allowed to marry a regular Jew. I mean, they can marry somebody who, like we said before, who's outside of the congregation, as we called it, whether it be a mamzer, whether it be another convert, but they can't marry the regular natural-born Jew. And the question, again, for this is what is this prohibition? So I just want to read to you what the Torah says about it, and then we'll discuss it. The Torah says, Lo yavo amoni mo'avi b'kal Hashem. An Ammonite or Moavite convert cannot enter the congregation of Hashem. Gam dor asir, even the 10th generation. Even that the 10th is not exact, meaning forever. Lo yavo lohem b'kal Hashem ad olam. They can never enter in. So the Gemara tells us this means only a male convert from Ammon, not a female convert. So a female convert can marry right away. Like the example of that is Rus. We learned Rus last year, 2 years ago. Rus converted from the land of Moab, and she married a Jew immediately. And that was fine, because female converts are allowed to marry male Jews. But a male Ammonite or Moabite convert cannot marry female Jews, and that goes on in their children forever. Any male from that union that will never be able to marry a regular Jew. So why is this? Before I even answer the why, I just want to point out that the Gemara tells us that the king Sancheriv, who was the king of Assyria, he was the one who exiled the 10 tribes. When he had his conquest over the world, he took all the nations and he moved them all around over the place. So the Gemara says nowadays this is not relevant because we don't know who's actually from these nations. So even if someone comes to me and claims, I'm from Ammon, or let's say you have a modern-day Egyptian. They say, I'm an Egyptian. They're not forbidden to marry Jews because we don't know, this is not really the original Egyptians. The people living there now may have been from somewhere else and got moved there 2,000 years ago. So the next four categories of people nowadays are not relevant to us, meaning that even though the halacha exists, we can never prove somebody's status in terms of where they came from because we just don't know, because the nations always got moved all around, and therefore we never limit someone's marriage based on these statuses.
Sancheriv did.
Yeah.
This is backward from most Torah-hitted doubt cases.
Yeah.
Where if there's a doubt,
you're stringent.
We don't do it.
Well, there's also a concept that you follow the majority. The majority of people in the world are not from these nations. That's the Gemara says. You go bus a rove. So, meaning if someone comes before you and he says, yeah, I'm a convert, you don't have to assume he's from the tiny percentage that might be one of these four nations. You assume he's from the majority of the world, which is not from these nations.
Okay. It's similar with finding a piece of meat in the street.
Yes, exactly. It's the same, okay. Same concept. So nowadays, any convert who comes before us can marry a Jew. No questions asked, because we have no way to prove that they came from any of these nations. But you go back 2,000 years ago, probably more than that, 2,500 years ago, then you had people who were actually real Ammonites, real Moabites, you know, real Egyptians or real Edomites, and therefore they have these limitations. So let's read about the Ammonites and Moabites. So it says that a male convert from Ammon or Moab cannot marry into the Jewish people, even past 10 generations, and then explains why. It says, Al-Davar Asher Lokimu Eschem Balechem Mayayim, because when you were in the desert, when the Jews were in the desert for 40 years, and they passed by the land of Ammon, or Moab, it's unclear which one we're discussing here, It says they didn't come out and greet you with bread and water. They should have come out and taken care of you, a wandering nation starving in the desert. They didn't come out and greet you with bread and water. And then it says also, Sachar Lechas Bil Memor, they hired, this was Balak, the king of Moab, hired Bilam to come curse us. In Parshas Balak, we have an entire parsha in the Torah discussing Moab's plot to curse the Jews. So because they went out against us in such a harsh way, that showed us something about these people. And therefore, because number one, they didn't greet us with bread and water, and number two, they hired Bilam to curse us, therefore, Hashem said they're forbidden to marry into the Jewish people. It says, Lo Hashem Olkech L'Shmol Bilam, Hashem, though, didn't listen to Bilam's curse, and Hashem flipped it into a blessing, because Hashem loves you. And then it says, you should not seek their shalom, their peace, or their tov, or their goodness, forever. So that's the Torah's harsh words about the people of Ammon and Moab. So these are the reasons given. Now, which nation did what? So it seems that Ammon didn't give us bread and water, and Moab hired Balak, who was the king of Moab, hired Bilam to curse us. So these two nations were nations which did bad things and didn't care for us. But what exactly, though? I mean, it was one act in history. It was one time. These are one-time events. And why does this give them a stigma forever? So it's very interesting. What are the roots of Ammon and Moab? Where did they come from? Anybody remember? From Lot's daughters. Right. So when Hashem destroyed Sodom, Hashem saved Lot, and Hashem saved Lot's daughters. He saved his wife also, but his wife got turned to salt along the way. But Hashem saved Lot and his daughters from the land of Sodom. Now we know that the daughters were scared that no one was left in the world, and they thought they were the last remaining human beings. So then they tricked their father, and they conceived from their father. And they named their two sons that came from this relationship, Ammon and Moab. So Ammon and Moab came from these roots. But take it even back a step. Why did Hashem decide to save Lot? Hashem saved Lot
because of Avraham.
Yes, because of Avraham. And these two nations, which are produced, were really products of Avraham's chesed. Avraham was someone who was known to be a pillar of chesed, of doing good and kindness to all people. And really, Lot and his daughters and all that came from them should be totally indebted to Avraham. Because Hashem only saved Lot because of Avraham. That's why they saved Lot. Lot himself didn't have any merit, but Rashi tells us that Hashem saved Lot because he was Avraham's nephew, and he deserved to be saved because of Avraham's merit. So these nations should have the deepest respect for the Jewish people. They should say, you're Avraham's children, we're Lot's children, we're indebted to you, we're only in existence because of you. Instead of that, not only did they not have that feeling of gratitude, they did evil to us. You know, they didn't take care of us, they tried to curse us. So this type of midah, this type of trait, this is the antithesis of what a Jew is. Jews are all about gratitude. No, we're called Yehudim, we're called Jews. The word Yehudim comes from the word hoda'ah, which is give gratitude, to give thanks. And one of the most essential traits of a Jew is the ability to recognize the good of others, because we're here in the world to recognize Hashem's goodness. That's what we're all about. So if we have nations which their entire existence should be built on gratitude, but yet they don't have that gratitude, that trait is poison to the Jewish people. We can't have that trait enter into our... So they're allowed to convert, but yet we don't want them to marry into the Jewish line of descendants, because we don't want to breed that trait amongst the Jews. Yeah.
Can we understand their being allowed to convert as a leniency that they're given because they're still the descendants of Lot, who was a nephew of Avraham?
Right. It could be, or you can say that we can accept you in, even if you happen to have a flaw. You can still be a Jew with a flaw. But they're Jews. We call them people who have an inborn flaw. Right. Again, we can never say this. This is something a human being can never actually say. But Hashem says that this nation has a flaw. This nation has a flaw. They don't have. They're ingrateful, and therefore these two nations, who should have deep gratitude, if they don't show gratitude, we can't have them as part of Klal Yisrael. Also, the very fact that they didn't do chesed to us is also a big no-no. Meaning, it says that they're blamed for not giving us bread and water as we came by when we were in the desert. One of the most essential Jewish traits is chesed, is to do kindness. And we know how every single Jew, observant or not, tzedakah is kind of like in the blood. We know that, I think the statistics show us that percentage-wise, Jews give much more tzedakah than non-Jews do in terms of proportion to their salaries. And you know, to be a Jew, but not have this inborn trait of chesed, is also considered, it can't be part of who we are. They could be Jews, but we can't let them enter in fully to the congregation because they're lacking an essential trait of being Jewish. On the other hand, we find that Rus is a Moabite convert. We said the female Moabite converts are allowed, and Rus excels in Chesed. But at least Rus stands for us as kind of the antidote to her ancestors, because she's somebody who the entire book of Rus tells us about the Chesed she would do to her mother-in-law. So this is the issue with Ammon and Moab. Beyond this prohibition, we're told at the end of this discussion, don't even seek out their peace or goodness forever. It's another mitzvah. So I forgot to mention the numbers like I usually do. Mamzer's mitzvah number 560, just by the way. Ammon and Moab is 561. And now we're up to 562, which is not to seek out the peace or goodness of Ammon and Moab. This one's kind of an aside to today's discussion, but just while we're at it, what this means is that typically when the Jews would go to battle, the times of the Torah, so they're supposed to first offer peace. So you would send them to the city and say, we'd like to make peace with you. If the city refused, then we're allowed to actually fight. When it comes to Ammon and Moab, we don't offer peace. We need to fight them, we just go ahead and fight. Because their conduct only deserves our anger and our fury. It doesn't deserve to make peace with us. So just to be clear, we're not supposed to start up with them. The Torah also says don't aggravate Moab. Al tatsaras Moab. You can't start up with them, but if a war is called for, you don't offer peace to these two nations, you go ahead and fight. So that's interesting. So we see these traits to be so rotten that they can't marry into the Jewish people even if they convert. And also, when we come to fight them, we don't want to make peace. Once there's an excuse to fight, we just fight against them. So that's the story of the Ammon and Moab. Now I move on to Edom. So there's the land of Edom. The Torah says, "Lo sesav Edomi kichichahu." Do not despise an Edomite, for he is your brother. And the Torah says, "Bani Mashri Valdu Lam Darshwishi." They're a third generation of children. They could marry Kal Hashem. They could marry into the congregation. So an Edomite convert, male or female, the first two generations cannot marry, meaning the convert himself or herself and their children. But the grandchildren could marry any Jew. So this is a very different than the Mamzer or the Ammonite or Moabite, who the prohibition is forever. When it comes to the Edomi, the grandchild is allowed to marry any Jew he or she would like.
There is a reason for why an Edomite can marry?
Yeah, so we're talking about it. So the Torah says so. The Torah says, Ki'achichahu. Because Edom descends from Esav. Esav, as much as we look at Esav as a wicked person, he was Yaakov's brother, his family. His family. Ammon and Moab is a much more distant family, right? But someone who's a brother of Yaakov, he's part of the family. And therefore, even though Esav maybe should be prohibited, maybe Esav is evil, Esav's a Rasha, we look at Esav in a very negative light in the Torah. However, family ties supersede that. And the family ties, ki achichu, for he is your brother, allow him into the congregation. Not initially. They need to have a little bit of time to kind of get out the Esav traits from them, so they convert. They take two generations to kind of clean out the system. The third generation, we say, okay, by now, hopefully you've cleaned out all of your wicked Esav traits. You are our brother, and therefore we'll let you in. And the third generation can marry anyone they like. Edom came out in the Midbar, in the desert, not with bread and water, but with the sword, the Torah says. So in some ways, they're even worse than Ammon and Moab, because Ammon and Moab didn't offer us bread and water. They're blamed for not giving us food. Edom came out with a sword, the Torah tells us. So it shows you how important the Torah holds family connections to be. I mean, even though Esav is considered a terrible Rasha, even though Esav's children came out to greet us with the swords in the desert, despite all, being a brother trumps everything. It's a very important concept. So the Torah gives us, and this is what all the commentaries describe about this mitzvah, the Torah gives us an imperative that we should follow really our natural feelings to be close to relatives. The closest to family is really very much a Torah value. The Torah recognizes and urges us to be close with family. We mentioned last week that part of the prohibition, or part of the idea of marriage, part of the issue with prostitution, we mentioned last week is that you have to know who your family is. Right? If people are just having children all over the place, then you don't know who's your brother, who's your sister, who's your father, who's your child, and the family unit is broken up. So the Torah very much looks at a family unit as very significant. And even though now we're dealing with generations later, these are now 15 cousins, whatever they're going to be at this point, it doesn't matter. Because Esav is your family, and even though Esav's terrible, you take in family. You have to show love to a relative, even the relative is not necessarily good to you. It's a relative. There's a pasuk. It says, "Mibisarcha tisam." Never hide from your flesh. Someone who's your flesh and blood, you're there for them, support them, care for them, do your best. The other commentaries point out that Edom in particular is a nation that we should take in because they do descend from the patriarchs. I mean, these are children of Abraham and Yitzchak. So even though they might have bad traits, they also carry very good traits because they come from our forefathers. So therefore, there is some merit they have to bring them into Klal Yisrael. And Ramban points out that you can never overlook the merit of ancestors, because even though they're not the greatest people, know where they come from. Recognize these people are coming from the same people you're coming from. You have the same stock, and they're coming from great stock. They're coming from Abraham, they're coming from Yitzchak. So it's a very fascinating thing. But to us, it's a message. You know, many people have stories in their own families, you know, cousins which you don't get along with, aunts and uncles which you have some sort of parting with, and it's difficult sometimes. But the Torah is stressing, you know, there's no way your cousin's worse than Esav. You know, no matter who your cousin is, he's not worse than Esav. And your cousin didn't come out and greet you with a sword, I'm assuming. So why aren't we talking to the Torah to this cousin? Because we have our issues. But if it's family, the Torah is teaching us, we have to get over it. We have to show family is supposed to be there to love and support one another. In times of emergency and urgent times, we're there for each other. Even that cousin of yours you don't talk to, when it comes down to it, probably you would be there for each other. So when something happens, when there's a tragedy, God forbid, when something occurs, they get back together again. That's a common story. So why wait for the tragedy? Get back together now. And recognize that your cousin is no worse than Esav. And despite that, Torah says, let Esav into the Jewish people. Let them convert and give them a little time, but let them come in. So it's a very important message from Edom. So they happen to be, there's a limitation because they are Esav, and they have to be kind of like a watch for two generations. But once the third generation occurs and they enter in, at that point, we accept them fully because they're family, and family is family. There's one other very important point made by the Sefer Chinuch about Esav. Now, Esav is, we know that Rome descends from Esav. Edom led into Rome. The current exile we're in began with the Roman destruction of the Second Temple, of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Romans, this is in the year 70, the Romans came in and destroyed the Second Beis HaMikdash. Ever since then, for about 2,000 years, we've been wandering the world, suffering, being tormented, being killed off, in very, very difficult situations. You name it, it's happened to us. You know, expulsions, persecutions, the Holocaust, everything. And we blame Rome for all this. I mean, they began it. They started it all. They initiated the entire process. What we're in now is called Galus Edom. It's the Galus. It's the exile created by Edom. So if we look at it from that perspective, well, we should let them in. I mean, look what they've caused. If you want to blame the Holocaust on them, you want to blame the Inquisition, you want to blame pogroms, you want to blame the tortures we've gone through, so why did they get to enter into the Jewish people? So one answer would be, like you said, family ties trump all, which is one answer. The Sefer HaChinuch says you have to always see that God runs the show. I mean, you can't harbor hatred forever against the Romans, because, yeah, they destroyed the temple. But the fact that we're still here, it's not their fault. It's our fault. I mean, have we improved our act? Have we done tshuva? Do we see that this is all a result of divine providence? And even though you might label what we're doing right now Gullus Edom, that was 2,000 years back. Edom no longer exists. We're still here, and we're still suffering. It's because we haven't yet seen that this is all God teaching us to do tshuva and become better people. So Sefer HaChinuch says that even though maybe we're upset with them, and obviously we do harbor hatred against those who destroyed our temple, that we can't let that linger. We have to understand that we have to do tshuva. It had to happen. You know, the Rambam asks the question, how come we punished Egypt? In the times of Sisera, why did they get 10 plagues? Why were they punished? Hashem told Abraham, he said, your children are going to be enslaved in a foreign land. There was a prophecy given. Hashem says to Abraham, your children will be enslaved in a foreign land. They're going to be persecuted. Eventually, they'll be freed. So when Egypt came in and punished us, Egypt came in and enslaved us. So they were essentially fulfilling God's prophecy. They could say, we're doing a mitzvah. We're just doing what God told us to do. God said that someone should enslave the Jews, so we're stepping up to the plate and we're doing God's bidding. So the answer the Rambam says is that, well, yeah, I mean, it had to happen, but you didn't have to do it. God has his ways, so God will figure it out. So you, Egypt, you chose to be the persecutors? Okay, you get punished for that. So the temple had to be destroyed, and we had to go into exile. So Edom came in and they did God's bidding, as it were. So yes, you know, we harbor hatred for them for doing such a thing, and they're punished for it. But ultimately understand this is all part of God's decree. And that decree is here because of us, not because of them. So they should have stepped up to the plate. Yeah, and we're upset with them and they punished for it. But ultimately, 2,000 years later, we can't keep our hatred against Edom. We don't look at Rome and say, these Romans are terrible. We say, what are we still doing here? It's because we haven't changed our own lives and become better people and better Jews. So that's the concept of Edom. Let's do one more mitzvah here. This is 564. This is the so in the same exact discussion, not to marry an Edomite, it says don't marry an Egyptian. Mean an Egyptian convert. This means male or female, but again, only up to three generations. So an Egyptian convert, first generation, second generation is forbidden to marry into the Kahal, to those who are in the regular born Jewish line. The third generation, meaning the grandchild of the convert, is allowed to marry any Jew. So why does it say this? It says, do not despise the Egyptian. Why? Because you are a stranger in their land. So this actually occurs a few times in the Torah. It's always hard for us to understand. We give credit to the Egyptians for hosting us in Egypt. Now, yeah, they hosted us, they made us slaves, and they killed our children, and they tortured us, and they made us stay up late at night doing jobs for them, and sent us off into the wilderness to fight wild animals. They did terrible things to us. But yet the Torah says, oh, you should not despise them because they're your hosts. And you have to recognize your hosts. So what does this mean? So it means that, you know, even though we suffered, you can never overlook the good done to you. Meaning in the very beginning, really we're seeing it in next week's Parsha, next few weeks in the Torah readings, in the Parsha, we'll see this. In the beginning, the Jews had a famine in Israel, and they went to Egypt, and they survived. And they're treated well. So that slowly turned into slavery, but that was later on. I mean, even if somebody does something bad to you now, you can't overlook the good that was done to you beforehand. That's the Torah's teaching us. I mean, you were cared for by the Egyptians. They were your hosts who saved your lives initially. So even though, yes, later on they enslaved you, and their character traits were certainly negative traits that they can enslave and torture human beings, that was a terrible thing. So they're limited again in who they can marry. Two generations, they get limited. Third generation, they're allowed in. Ultimately, they were kind hosts in the beginning. And you were in existence because of them. You would have died of starvation if not for them. So therefore, you have to show your gratitude. In the third generation, we allow them in. It's an important lesson for us as well, that sometimes we have a relationship with somebody for many years, and everything's great. And that person does one thing to us which is wrong, and really bothers us. So we're very quick to say, forget about this person, not my friend anymore, I'm not going to call them anymore, I'm done, finished. And the answer is, well, yeah, what they did was wrong, but are you forgetting the first 25 years where you were good friends? What happened to that? There's no credit, they don't have any credit for those 25 years where you were supporting each other, helping each other. Yeah, so for the past year, there's been tension, but you're forgetting the rest of it. So the Egyptians, there's plenty of tension. We had 200 years of slavery. But in the beginning, which lasted, I would say approximately 100 years or so, I don't know the exact numbers, where life was pretty good in Egypt, we can't forget that. You know, and therefore, the Egyptians, they get limited in who they can marry. The first generations have to keep their distance. We have to, again, kind of weed out the bad traits. But the third generation, we let them in because, like we said, gratitude to those do us good is an essential Jewish trait. So just like we said when it comes to Esav, family ties are a very, very important Jewish trait. So too is gratitude. And when we were strangers in their land and they saved us, we can't overlook that. So that's the concept of the Egyptian is limited, but then allowed in. So it's very important that in life we don't overlook good done to ourselves. It's a very important life lesson. Because we often say, you know, what was, and now things are different. The answer is you can't say what was. You say what was good. And I appreciate that. And now things are rocky. We'll deal with it now. And we do this all the time, you know, with family and friends. We do it with institutions. You know, this shul, I love davening there for 25 years. And then the president did something which I really can't stand, and I'm leaving. The answer is, okay, so the president, you have to deal with what they did. But 25 years, you enjoyed the shul, you liked the rabbi, you liked davening there, you had friends there. Why are you so upset now? You can't forget that. Politicians, we do it all the time. This politician, you know, I really like this the senator. And I voted for him or her in the past, you know, four elections. But then they had one stance I didn't like. So maybe you have to make the calculation, does it make sense or not? But you can't reject a person for one bad decision, necessarily. If it's a very important issue to you, then fine. But just you have to always put into perspective that I have to have gratitude to someone who did good for me for all these years. It's a very important stance to take in life. So we have here, we've mentioned five different examples or categories of people who are limited in their marriage to the Jewish people. Again, they're full-fledged Jews. There's no question about their Jewish status. We have to love them, care for them. They have to keep all the mitzvahs. We have to do all the mitzvahs towards them. But the marriage is limited or forbidden into the regular Jewish line based on the traits they carry. Again, I want to clarify, we have no right to make this determination. Only God can. I can't say, well, I hate the French. They shouldn't marry Jews. I can't say that, right? Whether you like the French or not, who are you to know? You can't read their minds. You can't read their hearts. And when Hashem says you can't marry a Moabite, Hashem says, I know what they're thinking in their hearts. I know their inborn traits, and I know 100% that there's rotten things in there which I don't want to be involved in my nation. So we would never do this on our own. When Hashem declares it, Hashem can make that determination. Okay. Any questions? Thank you.